6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. The Turkish government has detained thousands of people, mostly from the armed services, in the wake of Friday's failed military coup that left nearly 300 dead and hundreds more wounded. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has blamed a U.S.-based Muslim cleric, Fethullah Gulen, of orchestrating the coup attempt. Mr. Erdogan said his government is requesting Gulen's extradition. Appearing on U.S. television on Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry was asked if Gulen is complicit.
I have no knowledge. I have no evidence whatsoever at this point in time, but I talked with my foreign minister counterpart three times in the last day, and I urged him to compile the evidence that they have as rapidly as possible, provide it directly to us through the channels, and I pledged to him that according to our extradition treaty, according to our legal process and standards, we will immediately evaluate whether or not that evidence is sufficient to merit an extradition.
Gulen has denied any involvement in the coup attempt. Meanwhile, thousands of people attended funerals on Sunday in Istanbul and Ankara for those who were killed. Turkey also Sunday reopened its airspace to military aircraft, allowing the U.S.-led coalition to resume air operations against Islamic State militants. Prime Minister of Libya's unity government has appealed for that elusive unity in the embattled North African country. French press agency reports that Fayez al-Sarraj spoke a day after the UN hosted a meeting on creating a unified army. UN diplomat Martin Cobler said of Libya's problems are tied to security issues. This is VOA News. Process of identifying the victims of a truck attack in Nice, France, continued Sunday. 84 people were killed in the Thursday night attack on Nice's seaside promenade. Just 35 bodies have been identified definitely. Mohamed Boulel drove the 19-ton truck at 90 miles or 90 kilometers per hour, mowing down people over a 2-kilometer path. Islamic State claimed responsibility for Thursday's attack. Some say IS is seeking out petty criminals and the mentally ill to be their soldiers. Scott Stewart is a former U.S. State Department official, now with the private security firm Stratfor. He speaks with VOA via Skype.
The idea is to kind of motivate these folks to conduct very simple attacks using things they're capable of using close to where they live.
It remains unclear whether there was any direct connection between the attacker and the Islamic State. Boulel's family contends he was not religious and did not subscribe to extreme ideologies. Syrian government forces closed the only road leading into and out of rebel-held parts of the northern city of Aleppo, giving President Bashar al-Assad's forces one of their biggest successes in the civil war. Sunday's push raised fears among the city's civilian population of a humanitarian crisis, as many feared food and medicine will run out in Aleppo in a short time. A gunman identified as a former U.S. Marine who served in Iraq killed three policemen and wounded three others in the city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on Sunday. Colonel Mike Edmondson heads the Louisiana State Police.
Two from the Baton Rouge Police Department and one from East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office. One East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's deputy is in critical condition, just got out of surgery a short time ago. Two additional officers suffered non-life-threatening wounds. They are in stable condition at the hospital now.
The suspect, identified as Gavin Long, an African-American, was killed moments later by police. Shootings come 2 weeks after police fatally shot an American, African-American man in Baton Rouge, sparking a reprisal shooting in Dallas, Texas, leaving five policemen dead. President Obama spoke Sunday, saying that this is happening far too often.
5 days ago, I traveled to Dallas for the memorial service of the officers who were slain there. I said that that killer would not be the last person who tries to make us turn on each other, nor will today's killer. It remains up to us to make sure that they fail.
Mr. Obama appealed for less divisive rhetoric and a focus on words and actions that unite the country.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, July 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union denies a split in the organization as leaders vote today to choose a new chairperson.
There's no ECOWAS concern that has made an election to be postponed. If somehow we're not able to obtain the necessary majority, then the rules will kick in and you will be advised as to the outcome.
Vincent Omihile is the African Union's legal counsel. Meanwhile, Uganda says its candidate stands a better chance of winning today's vote. We'll have analysis of Morocco's return to the African Union after a 32-year absence, and IGA calls on all warring forces to be removed from South Sudan's capital.
Today, IGA had a meeting on South Sudan. They would like both forces of Riek Machar and Salva Kiir to be out of Juba, and they have suggested that a protection force composed of regional armies to be located in Juba to take charge of the security in that situation.
Henry Okello Onyem is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. There are mixed results for the multinational force fighting Boko Haram in Nigeria. Zimbabwe opposition leader appoints new party leaders. Experts say optimism about the end of AIDS is misplaced. And Cameroon becomes the latest African country to detect the avian influenza. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union Summit meeting in Kigali, Rwanda, will be voting for a new AU Commission chairperson today, Monday, despite rumors of a call for the election to be delayed. Nick Long has more from Kigali.
There have been persistent rumors at the summit that the ECOWAS bloc of West African states is unhappy with the choice of candidates offered to succeed outgoing AU Commission chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. There are three candidates, two of them women, former Uganda Vice President Speciosa Wandira Kazibwe and Botswana Foreign Minister Pelonomi Vincent Moitoi and Equatorial Guinea Foreign Minister Agapito Mba Mokwi. Late Sunday, an AU legal counsel, Vincent O. Mehiele, denied the rumours of a delay.
Stop speculating. There's no ECOWAS concern that has made an election to be postponed. Elections are going forward tomorrow. No more names will be entering the lists while the election is going on tomorrow. If somehow we're not able to obtain the necessary majority, then the rules will kick in and you will be advised as to the outcome.
ECOWAS does not determine whether AU Commission elections are held, he added. AU rules say the winning candidate must obtain two-thirds of member states' votes. Mehiele explained that if no one wins this majority in the first round, the candidate with least votes will be knocked out and a second round held. If a two-thirds majority is still not obtained, he said, the election will be suspended pending another vote and an interim chairperson appointed. One journalist questioned the democratic credentials of some of the candidates' home countries. Mehiele declined to comment.
Can you define democracy for me? Because you say candidates from undemocratic countries. I don't know what you mean. They are members of the African Union. To be a candidate, it is open to all members of the African Union.
According to AU rules, the Commission Chairperson and Deputy Chairperson are elected by heads of states or their representatives at the summit, while the eight commissioners are elected by member states' foreign ministers. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
Uganda says its candidate for the position of chairperson of the African Union Commission stands a better chance of winning when the vote is cast today, Monday, at the African Union Summit in Kigali, Rwanda. Henry Okello Onyem, Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, dismissed the argument made by some that Uganda should not be given the chance to hold such an important AU office because the country under President Yoweri Museveni has a checkered record on democracy. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Okello Onyem says the regional group IGA has resolved that all forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar must leave Juba and be replaced by a protection regional force that would take care of security in Juba.
Today, IGA had a meeting on South Sudan, and they re-emphasized the position that was agreed in Nairobi. But more importantly, today they emphasized the need for militarizing Juba. They would like both forces of Riek Machar and Salva Kiir to be out of Juba, And they have suggested that a protection force composed of regional armies to be located in Juba to take charge of the security in that situation.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon put out a statement. He sounded very angry about the situation in South Sudan. He called for targeted sanctions, arms embargo, and strengthening the United Nations forces there. Does IGAD support the Secretary General's position?
IGAD, of course, has absolute sympathy with the position of the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who was here. So IGAD had a meeting today, and IGAD's position is that at this stage, what's important is demobilizing Juba of all forces of Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, and we're moving in the regional forces to take charge of the security of Juba and the line and the districts. And then once the situation is pacified, then they will see how to move into other issues of embargo and travel ban and so on and so forth.
So, Minister, what are Ugandan troops doing in South Sudan? Because some people say you are there to protect President Salva Kiir.
That's rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Our troops in South Sudan, the Kuwait Ugandans who are stranded in South Sudan, we have already evacuated over 5,000 of our nationality. We have helped evacuate people from other nationalities, Indians, Chinese, Nigerians, and many other African people. We are solely there to ensure that there's a safe passage for all those we are evacuating from the outskirts of Juba back into Uganda.
The African Union Commission is looking for a new chairperson, and Uganda, we understand, is one of the candidates. What are your chances there?
Our chances are very good. Our candidate is Dr. Steven Kazibwe, who served as a minister in President Museveni's government for many years, and then eventually was appointed the first woman vice president in Africa, where she served for 9 years. She's a doctor by profession, and for all intents and purposes, she meets the benchmark to be the chairperson of the AU Commission.
So what do you say to those who say that Uganda should not be qualified because of its democratic credentials are not that very good? They cite, for example, your treatment of the opposition during and after the last February election, the presidential election. What do you say to that?
I think there's something in the Bible where it says that he who has not committed any sin should cast the first stone. Whoever is saying that should first of all look at into their own house and ask themselves shortcomings in their own administration, whoever it is, without exception.
Mr. Minister, the International Criminal Court has referred Uganda and Djibouti to the UN Security Council because it said you failed to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir when he visited your country earlier this year. What do you say to that?
I think the ICC has lost credibility. The ICC should listen to Africa. But if the ICC keep ignoring Africa and not listening to Africa's concern about the selective manner in which they execute their justice, unfortunately, that will be the beginning of the end of the ICC as we know it.
Henry Okello Oyem is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. He was speaking with me from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. An Africa analyst is welcoming the return of Morocco to the African Union after nearly a 32-year absence over Western Sahara. Morocco considers the territory as part of the kingdom and insists its sovereignty cannot be challenged. J. Peter Farm, director of the Africa Center at the Washington-based Atlantic Council, says Morocco is the second largest African investor in Africa after South Africa, and its 32-year absence was a loss to the African Union. Besides, he says, majority of African countries do not support the Polisario Front, and the decision by the African Union to recognize the self-proclaimed Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic as a former member was a unilateral one.
Remember, Morocco left because of a questionable decision not made by a formal vote, but made by the then Secretary General of the Organization of African Unity in 1984 to admit the secessionist Polisario Front as a member of the Organization of African Unity. That's important to remember. There was never a vote. It was a decision of the Secretary General, not a vote of the member. But as a result, Morocco left the OAU and never was part of the African Union. So in that sense, Africa was poorer for the absence of Morocco. Morocco transacts 11% of all the business in Africa, is the second largest African investor in Africa after South Africa and the largest African investor in West Africa. To not have Morocco in the African Union hurts Africa as a whole more than it hurts Morocco, which, as those economic figures I just cited to you, has done quite well in the years since.
As you mentioned, the Polisario situation has been ongoing for some time now. What happened now that's making Morocco to return to the African Union?
Well, the fact that the majority of African Union members don't even recognize the Polisario. Of the 54 members of the African Union, if you don't count the Polisario, there are 53 members. Of the 53, less than 20 officially recognize Polisario. And of those less than 20, not all of them even they recognize it on paper. They don't actually have real relations. So what you have is a small minority within the overall AU having up to now held hostage the majority. With Morocco's reentry, I think what made it possible is the fact that a majority of African Union members don't recognize the Polisario and have relations with Morocco.
It seems to me that the situation in Western Sahara hasn't fully been resolved. And so soon,
there will never be an independent Western Sahara. Morocco occupies most of it as part of its national territory. The people there vote in Moroccan elections. And the fact that a majority of African Union members don't recognize the Polisario. It's only a handful of countries holding on to pipe dreams and revolutionary fantasies from the 1960s. That's why it's a good sign that the AU, at least on this issue, has shifted for the better.
When you say shifted for the better, is the African Union saying to Morocco, yes?
What I'm saying is a majority of African Union member states do not recognize today the Polisario.
So, I mean, a Polisario or the Western Sahara will now go to Morocco fully.
Morocco has been governing and administering and building up the Western Sahara for almost 40 years.
J. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Washington-based Atlantic Council. He was speaking with me from Rabat, Morocco. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today is Monday, July 18th, and I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The militaries of Nigeria and Cameroon say Boko Haram is back on the defensive in the face of an offensive by a multinational task force. But as VOA's Chris Stein reports from Lagos, analysts have raised questions about the task force's effectiveness.
Last year, leaders and top military officials from Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin gathered in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to reinvigorate a coalition to fight Boko Haram. The multinational joint task force had existed for years as a crime-fighting force, but was now repurposed to take on the Islamist militant group. Analysts have long called for more cross-border cooperation against Boko Haram, which started in Nigeria and wants to impose strict Islamic law on the country's north. The region's borders are porous and practically non-existent in places. As pressure from Nigeria's military has grown, fighters have sought refuge on islands in Lake Chad, in the desert on the border of Niger, and in the mountainous frontier with Cameroon. More than a year after the summit, John Campbell, a fellow at the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations and former American ambassador to Nigeria, says it is difficult to tell how much of an impact the task force has had.
It would be transformative if it led to the destruction of Boko Haram, and it has not.
Obtaining verifiable information about any aspect of the war against Boko Haram is difficult. Nigeria retains strict control on who can access combat zones and generally does not allow journalists to accompany its troops. Nigeria's military says it has carried out joint patrols with Cameroonian troops and that Chadian planes provided airstrikes during a recent battle. Spokesman Rabbi Abubakar told VOA that Nigeria has shared intelligence gathered by Cameroon-based American drones, thanks to the task force.
For the past three or four weeks, we have been doing that operations in concert with other nations within the Lake Chad Basin countries.
Cameroon military spokesman Colonel Didier Bajek says the task force is configured so that troops from each country operate in their own territory. They are authorized to cross borders if necessary.
If everybody is playing his role in the zone, Boko Haram is finished.
Boko Haram still controls territory in Nigeria and operates along the country's borders, as it was before the reinvigorated task force was deployed. Jan St. Pierre, CEO of Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says the task force, which is based in the Chadian capital N'Djamena, seems to work only in fits and starts. The four militaries involved speak different languages and have their own rivalries in politics. That undermines the ability to keep the coalition working together consistently.
We're really talking about a regional coalition that it's everybody's on his own and collaborating when there's need to and basically when they're forced to.
More than 20,000 people have been killed and 2.7 million displaced by the Boko Haram conflict since it began in 2009. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
In Zimbabwe, the Movement for Democratic Change founding president and former prime minister, Moki Tsvangirai, has increased the size of his party's executive council by appointing two deputies. Thomas Chiripasi has more from Harare.
Tsvangirai announced the appointments at his Harare residence, flanked by his wife Elizabeth and his spokesperson Luke Tamborinyoka. This comes at a time when the opposition leader is battling cancer of the colon.
Instead of appointing one, I'm going to appoint two to assist me and the vice president in charting this party towards the 2018 election. I have considered a number of factors, maturity, seniority, demographic considerations. We must not forget that we have a young generation that is now emerging, that is demanding that we do something about that. So in that regard, I am going to propose that Elias Mzuri will be one of the vice presidents. Nelson Chamisa will be one of the vice presidents. We now have a work to do and to mobilize all the people and to ensure that we have this task to discharge.
Mzuri welcomed the appointment, saying he would work hard to ensure that the struggle for democracy in Zimbabwe was completed.
I want to appreciate the trust that the president has given me in terms of assisting him in trying to run the party.
Tsvangirai said this move is meant to strengthen the opposition party ahead of the 2018 elections, adding that the appointments would not affect his elected deputy, Tokozani Kupe. He said the economic situation prevailing in the country, that saw many people countrywide protesting against the government in recent weeks, needed the coming together of all pro-democracy forces. In this context, Tsvangirai said there was need to establish a multi-partisan national transitional authority.
The National Council resolved that there has to be a political settlement that inspires confidence nationally, regionally, and internationally. To this end, the National Council, the party's supreme making body in between Congress, resolved that the way forward is a multi-partisan national transitional authority.
Tsvangirai also called on President Robert Mugabe to leave office or face civil unrest. Some analysts said Tsvangirai was laying his exit strategy plan by appointing Chamisa and Mzuri as some of his deputies. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The United Nations has set a goal of eradicating AIDS by 2030, but activists and experts say such a plan does not take into account political and financial realities and will never see fruition. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg ahead of the International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa.
Everyone agrees it sounds like a wonderful goal. The United Nations AIDS Agency's new five-year plan aims to end the deadly epidemic by the year 2030. Their 90-90-90 plan aims for 90% of people living with HIV to know their HIV status, 90% of HIV-positive people being on treatment, and 90% of people on treatment showing suppressed viral loads. This plan would prevent nearly 28 million new HIV infections and 21 million AIDS-related deaths worldwide. As more than 10,000 activists, experts, scientists, and patients converge on the city of Durban, itself an epicenter within AIDS-burdened South Africa, for the International AIDS Conference beginning Monday, even the optimists say such a goal is not so simple. That doesn't mean it's not possible, says Matthew Kavanaugh, senior policy analyst for the U.S.-based Health Global Access Project. Some countries, he says, have reached the 90-90-90 goals, while others are close. Kavanaugh says the end of AIDS could be within reach if donors invest more money and governments show more political will to fight the disease. He sharply criticized major donors, among them the United States and European nations, for prioritizing other crises. He spoke to VOA from Durban and said he's worried that talk about the end of AIDS may overshadow problems at the conference.
So Ban Ki-moon is heading to Durban right now, and what I hope is that I don't hear a lot of happy talk about how we're on track to end AIDS, because we're not. We could be, But the world is not showing the political will. But given that we're not on track, we need to be hearing about how there's an emergency, how donors need to step up, how affected countries need to step up, how there needs to be a radical change in how we do business, or we won't end AIDS.
Anele Yawa is Secretary General of South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign, which lobbies for social justice, including for South Africans living with HIV. The nation carries the world's highest AIDS burden, with UNAIDS estimating that 7 million people are infected. Yawa says those patients are not receiving needed services, citing chronic drug shortages, poor healthcare service, and too few healthcare workers. Yawa says he plans to participate in a protest during the conference to demand improvements. Durban last hosted the International AIDS Conference in 2000, and it made global headlines for all the wrong reasons. At the time, South Africa's government all but denied AIDS existed and did little to fight it. Today, 3.1 million South Africans receive antiretroviral treatment through government-funded programs. But experts warn success can be a distraction. As conference attendees discuss the latest work on treatment, vaccines, and maybe even a cure, more than half of HIV-positive South Africans remain untreated. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroon has become the latest African country to detect the avian influenza, or H5N1, within its borders. There are now six West and Central African countries battling the outbreak. In addition to Cameroon, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Niger are also dealing with the losses of millions of dollars that the virus has caused on poultry markets. Erin Reisman, a senior animal health officer at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, tells Ricky Schreier that while there is a small risk of the disease being transmitted to humans, they are greatly concerned with the loss of livelihoods and risks for food security.
Cameroon has a very thriving economy. I mean, it's developing very fast, and also the poultry industry is developing fast. Due to this growth, more and more people are involved in the poultry value chain, which means that more and more people are depending in their livelihood on poultry products. And therefore, we are very concerned about the spread of the disease into Cameroon. It's a big country. Also, the fact that from Cameroon, it's open to South Africa, through other countries, although the industry there is not as important. But if it could spread from Nigeria to Cameroon, it can spread to other countries in West Africa and make the situation even worse. I strongly believe that our role is to protect livelihoods.
And in order to, I believe, protect these livelihoods, what you guys are saying, one of the main things that needs to happen is, of course, surveillance, where the chickens are coming from and where they're going in order to stop the virus. What kind of surveillance can be offered? A lot of these borders are very porous.
We are trying constantly to reinforce surveillance in different parts of each country, particularly on the border and in live bird markets. You know, live bird markets is a huge cultural and economic importance in Africa. Birds that are getting sick die very fast. But what happened is that from the same flock, the owner will take the birds and send immediately to the market. So if they don't die immediately, they will die shortly after they are purchased. And of course, meanwhile, they spread the virus all over. It's very important to catch this virus on a timely manner. You can do it just by observing the birds' behavior, or you can take samples from them and test them. The problem in testing is that it takes time to run the test, it takes time to ship the samples, etc., particularly in the circumstances in Africa or West Africa and Central Africa.
That was Erin Reisman, a senior animal health officer at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Rome. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United States has reassured the people and the government of South Sudan that it is not planning to target any government or military leaders, nor will it import special military equipment with the goal of destabilizing South Sudan. A statement by State Department Deputy Spokesman Mark Turner says any suggestion that the United States has done so or will do so is false and baseless. And that's it for this Monday, July 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very productive week.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the Republican National Convention and what a Republican presidency could mean for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.